Okay, go ahead.
Okay, well, I guess maybe January, February, March of 58, winding down toward June graduation.
Mm-hmm.
I got a letter from Colonel Factor in Pentagon, and he said, Jim, I've been fooling for your career, and I'm in an organization, I can't tell you anything about it, but if you'd like to come up here and work for me, I'd like to have you. I've already got arrangements made for you to come if you want it. So I wrote him back, again, like I told General Canterbury, boss, if you want me, that's where I'm going to be. So here I graduate, and the family, we took the family to Irving until I could get up there. Until you and I could get up there and find a place to live.
Yeah. We lived kids with
her. Oh, okay. In the area surrounding Washington. We lived in Alexandria, Virginia. But I went in and reported to Colonel Factor, and he said, I want you to schedule tomorrow for a mission briefing, and don't expect anything except lunch, because it's quite comprehensive. And I must tell you now, you have a top secret clearance, but that's not good enough. You also have a Q clearance, which is atomic clearance.
Yes.
That's not good enough. He says, there are only a few hundred people in the world that even know this exists, other than maybe intelligence of foreign countries where it might have inadvertently leaked. And he says, you're all cleared for this. I've already arranged your clearance for this.
Did that clearance have a name? I know about Q clearance.
It didn't. Uh-huh.
Okay, so this was something that was kind of on its own, didn't have a...
Well, let's see, what did they call it? They called it a need to know.
Okay, sure.
Need to know. And that meant that it had to be deeply involved in what we were doing.
Okay.
For all of the time, for the rest of my career in the Air Force, she never did know what I did during those 10 years, except what she could see on service, on the base and all.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't know what was happening.
I really didn't want to know.
And
had you come to that point where you just...
Yeah, I thought I might say something that I don't mean to say.
Mm-hmm.
So, but...
So you didn't talk much about work when you saw each other. I'm sure you had other things, though, kids and all.
I'll digress from that period and go on fast forward.
Okay.
One day after I retired in Granbury, I was sitting here reading Air Force magazine, and all of a sudden I turn a page, it says Air Force Special Weapons Center. This was offshoot of F-01. I started reading that. Here's our mission.
Here it is.
I handed that to Minnie Mae, and I said, "Want to see something interesting?"
You're funny.
Is that what you were doing on it?
Yeah.
You know, I would watch him pack. He packed his own bag when he traveled.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of look what kind of, is he taking winter clothes or summer clothes?
Or civilian clothes.
Or civilian clothes, or both, or all of them. You know, I didn't know where I was going. And the children would say, Where's Daddy?
Yeah, where's Daddy?
Yeah. I'm going to compress 10 years into a pretty short time here. But
now, is this by necessity or because you feel we should?
Oh, well, it's just kind of, it's all encompassing. The same thing I'll tell you here. Hey, you can ask any question.
Yeah, okay.
It's completely declassified.
Yes. Right.
What we did, we operated the U.S. Atomic Energy Detection System, AEDS, U.S. AEDS. Which is now wide open.
Mm-hmm.
But, that comprised of a buildup, not the day in 1958 when I reported in, but it was the beginning of it started in 1949, I think,
mm-hmm.
with General Eisenhower, no, wait a minute, General Truman, President Truman, saying, we've got to do something to monitor nukes from Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very minor, and that was after World War. And I, for life, I mean, I can't think what happened.
Well, you'll find out when you wake up.
Right, and we can add it to this later.
Okay. But that's what it was initially. And then it changed names several times, becoming eventually the Air Force Technical Application Center, which it is today.
Mm-hmm.
It had Washington office when I got in it. It had the Washington office, and it had three field offices, one in Wiesbaden, Germany, one in Sacramento, California, and one in Yokota, Japan, which subsequently moved back to Hawaii.
Okay.
And they had their own areas of responsibility. Germany had all of Europe, Africa, Mideast, as far down as India and Ceylon. The United States had all of North America, South America, and the one in Japan and Hawaii had the Pacific Rim, Australia, New Zealand, and that as monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we did, what our mission was to detect the advancement in nuclear technology of Russia and China, and in some cases, France. Good old
okay.
France.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They didn't share all of their information with us. They wanted to be a member of the nuclear group, but they wouldn't share all their information with us. So we had to suspect them and monitor them closely.
Okay.
We knew the British, every time they wanted to pop one, we knew in advance.
Right, and there was a lot of collaboration, a lot of Anglo-American mm-hmm. collaboration, but of course the French not.
So to accomplish this mission, we eventually had around 330 detachments scattered throughout the world. And when I first walked in, and Colonel Factor said go to that briefing, and they started telling me where we had some detachments, I didn't even know a country existed, let alone an Air Force detachment in it. And the detachments consisted of about 11 people, one officer and 10 airmen, and they worked 24-hour shift, except it was cut down drastically in the evenings. You had to monitor the equipment in the evening, in the night,
uh-huh.
for any indication of an adverse effect on the atmosphere or the surface of the Earth through seismic, mm-hmm. acoustic,
mm-hmm.
Electromagnetic, and there's so many included in electromagnetic, I don't remember them all, but those three were the main three that we monitored the activities throughout the world from these detachments scattered all over. And when something unusual would happen, like even an earthquake,
mm-hmm.
it would trigger seismic. And the seismic guys would say, well, triangulated right here. This detachment would say, there's the direction, here's the direction, there's the direction, triangulate.
Mm-hmm.
And the acoustic guys would say, well, we got that air change, atmospheric change, a sudden atmospheric change okay. through our system. And here, there, and so forth, correlates with what you got, the electromagnetic, the same way. So once we got the triangulation of where this occurred, we knew pretty well whether it was an event of nature or whether it was an actual nuclear event. Because of the difference in the handwriting in the instrument, if you will, the wiggle of the needle in the instrument.
There was a signature.
The signature is a little bit different. But it got to where we knew exactly where the Russians were going to, the Soviet Union was going to test, where China was going to test, because we knew where we tested. We knew they knew where we tested,
right.
Nevada and the Pacific.
Right.
And they had the same thing, I guess. But then when we would triangulate on a specific point, we had a special weather forecast section in this outfit I was in. And God bless them, there were no reporting stations throughout Asia.
There were no stations when you came in?
None that would report openly. They might report it locally, but not where we got the weather reports.
Okay.
So this weather detachment, oh boy, they were... Let me regress just a minute. With that 1.4 priority,
yeah.
this organization was just filled with the elite of the elite. And I'm not bragging on me.
Mm-mm.
But they were highly selected for individual positions. And even the airmen, the same way that our personnel people go down to San Antonio Personnel Center and look over record after record after record. We want that guy, we want this guy, we want that guy, based on what they read there. And then they would send him to our school up at Lowry and train him in these techniques.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. So there was a training facility in
at Lowry.
At Lowry Field?
At Denver.
Uh-huh.
And it was run by us in conjunction with the training command, Air Force Training Command.
Uh-huh.
I think it was maybe the 2nd Air Force, I don't remember for sure. But once we triangulated this, then these special weather people would put their best thinking to try to determine where that air mass was going to move and when it would emanate out into legal airspace for us to get an airplane in and get a sample of it. That was usually the Pacific Rim, anywhere along from Japan all the way down to the Philippines.
And that's because an event on the Asian landmass anywhere would be moving out
west
toward
to east.
Yeah, west to east.
Usually.
So you would wait till.
We'd wait. Well, the weather people would say, based on what we can determine, it'll
sure.
be about this date. Well, in conjunction with these 337 detachments.
Mm-hmm.
We had sampling equipment on various major air commands airplanes. We only owned 2 airplanes and AFTAC. We owned initially a C-47 and a C-54. We got rid of the C-54 and the C-47 and got a C-118. And we had sampling equipment on it. It was also used as one of the general's airplanes to scoot around various places in the country. But we had agreement with SAC to put sampling equipment into their bomb bay on the B-52, the B-36. I believe that was all with SAC. We had, and the U-2.
Okay.
We had an agreement with the Air Weather Service to put it on their B-50s initially, and then the B-47 and the KC-135.
And this second agreement was with who again?
The second one
mm-hmm.
was with
the weather.
SAC.
Yeah, first was with
SAC. And then Air Weather Service.
Air Weather Service.
Air
okay.
Weather Service. Mm-hmm. And let me think just a minute now. Seems like another weather service, another service in there that we use their airplanes had samplers on. I don't recall. It seems like we had 3 different commands that we put these samplers on. And in addition to the sampler,
mm-hmm.
any airplanes that would accommodate, oh, wait a minute, I know it was TAC on some
of
their TAC
mm-hmm.
airplane.
Mm-hmm.
On some of their F-84s.
Okay.
Because we had that sampling squadron at Kirtland,
but
it wasn't
sense.
Involved with AFTAC. It was strictly ARDC, Air Resources and Development,
mm-hmm.
at that time. We designed the equipment to fit the airplane, and whoever built the airplane had to agree that it had no effect on the aerodynamics of the airplane.
Okay.
And in some cases, an example of B-52 and B-36, the pod that we put up in the bomb bay was probably the width of 4 of those cabinet doors.
So about
and
6 feet, maybe?
Maybe
more?
Maybe 7, uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
And about 7 or 8 feet long. And in that, we had several different circular type pad type samplers, like rice paper, circular rice papers. it worked kind of like the old Nickelodeons. It didn't work where you put one in, you take it out, and then push another one in, take it out, push another one in.
Right. And they're all lined up?
Lined up, yeah.
And then you would...
With one air scoop flowing through.
Got it. Uh-huh.
And once the operator inside read the radiation that was collected on the first one, he'd take it out, put a clean one in, and see if the direction they were flying would increase this. If so, they'd keep flying that direction.
Okay.
Because they're, well, first, let me back up again. They would go to, as an example, the Pacific Rim. They go to the Pacific Rim and start flying square patterns, expanding square patterns, hoping that they would find a piece of the debris that's coming in this air mass. Once they get any kind of radiation index on these sampling papers, then they go to work right in the whole area there and keep reading. And if the second or third paper decreases, they'll turn around. They want this max collection.
Right, they're trying to get. Each time they hit something, they're trying to make sure that they follow direction-wise such that they get increased hits.
That's right.
Each time so that they can get the volume of the air that's contaminated effectively and now, try to measure that.
Now, these big things on B-30, B-36, and B-52 had three of those air ducts. So the operator, our operator, sitting in the B-52, punches buttons and moves all of them at his discretion based on what he's seeing on his instruments up here.
Sure.
In addition to that, when we begin to get the hot spot, we have had huge wire-enforced balls, steel balls, hollow, to pump air into. And we pump this air into that ball. And then he would close the valve on it.
Seal it.
Seal it. And then when the airplane would get back to A base, wherever it was, we had to set up special couriers to get those samples back to one of three laboratories, one in Yokota, Japan, one in Austin Air Force Base in Alaska, and one at McLaughlin Air Force Base in our biggest laboratory in Sacramento. And our Air Force sign, it's not AEC, but our Air Force sign is there, both being civilian and military, would analyze this data and could reconstruct the weapon in its entirety, tell exactly what the nuclear activity was, exactly what the case consisted of, exactly what the detonator was, and they could almost reconstruct the shape of the weapon based on these little bitty particles. I'm talking about pinheads smaller than particles that we'd get. And then we would send this to the AEC for their evaluation on what it showed, the increase in technology in these Soviet Union
Our
plants.
So you're measuring by making these physical measurements of
last
the samples.
Year, this year, that year.
You could watch the technology change in the enemy.
Now, the way the AEC knew whether or not we were accurate, going back now to the nuclear test, when ARDC testing for the when I was in ARDC, this outfit was testing then, but the, unbeknown to me, testing the same tests that we were helping AEC with, and this organization, AFTAC, Air Force Technical Application Center, would take their samples from a known test, known AEC test. AEC would only say, on a certain date, we're shooting this shot at this location. You do whatever you want to get samples. So they would get samples, send them back to these laboratories.
The Air Force would?
Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
AFTAC.
AFTAC, okay.
And they'd take these samples, analyze them, send them to AEC and say, grade us on what you knew was going to happen at that site and what your analysis was of that site, 99.9%.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So they knew we were accurate. getting the...
And so that refined the techniques for them.
Very much so. Now, the other sample orders that we had, example, on the KC-135, had a big sampler on the outside of the fuselage where we had an operator sitting inside with an occluded type thing. On the U-2, we had another pod, much smaller than the B-36, B-52, and it only had one Nickelodeon type sampler that the pilot himself had to operate.
The pilot had to?
And in the fighters also.
Well, in a U-2, but there's only one guy, right? So
yeah.
He's got to do everything.
Right? But the U-2s were extremely important to us because of the extreme altitude they could get to, so we know what was happening up there, so to speak. And we didn't have too much aerial monitoring in the southern hemisphere because of the magnetic flow of the Earth's properties, whatever. And the scientists just didn't think that too much was would all cross over in the southern hemisphere. Mm-hmm. But we found they were wrong by another system that we had in AFTAC, where we would work with the embassies throughout the world, through the air attaché office in the embassy, mm-hmm. throughout the world to buy wine, and also to take air samples with these balls I mentioned earlier. And then they'd ship that back to us in Washington in a diplomatic pouch that no one knew anything about. Now, why wine? Well, the grapes absorb what's in the atmosphere out here. On the bottle it says, vintage 1959, 1963, so forth. So, a bottle of 1959 would show this much radioactivity in it. We had the biggest wine cellar in the world, probably.
No kidding.
Nobody ever touched it.
Now was this at Sacramento? Was this all kept at?
No, this was in Washington D.C.
Okay, because the air attaché's things would all go to D.C.
To the State Department.
To the State Department.
And then we'd pick them up at the State Department, take them to our scientists there in the headquarters in Washington. Wait a minute. They contracted this out to a civilian contractor there in the Washington, D.C. area somewhere, Maryland or Virginia.
Do you know which contractor it was?
I don't know. Uh-huh. I don't remember.
Sure.
I knew at the time.
Sure.
But they would then take this wine and run it through, get the radioactivity out of it, tell whether or not this particular area had increased in the amount of radioactivity mm-hmm. this year versus
over,
this year.
Over the past year.
And if so, what caused that? Mm-hmm. So eventually, AFTAC commander went to Chief of Staff of the Air Force and said, we think we need to go to the Southern Hemisphere with U-2s. To make a long story very short, we set up a detachment in Australia and a detachment in Argentina and sampled the air with the U-2s, and those papers were sent back to McClellan. And then after, we found it very minimal down there, so those detachments were vacated after about 2, maybe 3 years.
And would this have been in the early 1960s, do you think? Or
this was...
or even earlier?
Yeah, early 60s, uh-huh.
Okay.
Now maybe late 59, early 60, 61,
okay.
Throughout that period. Because I went down to Australia to help set up the detachment there, and I visited a detachment in Argentina. That was in 60. I went 61 to Australia. So
now, the detachments, in setting them up, these two that you're speaking of in the Southern Hemisphere, did they follow the same pattern of 11 people?
No. These detachments were SAC people.
Oh, these were SAC.
And only one AFTAC person.
Okay.
AFTAC just to say, here's what we need to do, and here's what we're going to do with the papers when you bring them back.
Oh, okay.
You so run the mission.
So it's much more simplified from the APTAC.
Yeah. SAC and their people on site.
Already there.
In Australia and Argentina, with only one APTAC person.
And your role in general during all of this?
My role, when I first started out, I was the director of air operations in headquarters in Washington, D.C. for almost four years.
Let's
see, we left there.
After command staff.
58, and left there in April of 62, 4 years. And I went then to Wiesbaden, to the field office there as director of operations, not just air operations, but director of operations, which included any air operations that came into our area and all of the ground detachments.
So director of all operations for that regional office. And how many of the 300 and some detachments were assigned to Wiesbaden?
Off the top of my head. Probably 75 or 80, stretching all the way from Kirkenes, Norway. You never heard of that town?
No, sir.
The very northern tip of Norway. It has a little, very short, maybe, I'm guessing now, 25-mile border with Russia. And that's an interesting story. While I'm there, I'll just tell that story.
Okay.
I had to go up there a couple of times, but I had to go through the Norwegian CIA system. I would report to Oslo, and I would go in, and they would make me Johard Johansson or somebody like that, and give me a passport like that.
Norwegian passport.
Norwegian
just to clarify.
Passport. Mm-hmm. Diplomatic passport.
Even better.
And the CIA guy, who was actually a Norwegian Air Force guy working for CIA, would accompany me. I couldn't speak Norwegian. Mm-hmm. He said,
say a word.
Unless we're separated from group, don't you say a word. Because Norway had an agreement with Russia.
Yeah.
They would allow no NATO forces above the Arctic Circle.
Right. Yes.
But we had a detachment up in Sheerness near the Russian border. So when this Norwegian escort took me up there twice, first time he said they had a car waiting for us at the airport, and he said, Jim, first thing we've got to do is drive out to the checkpoint between the borders. He says, they know you're here. We've got to keep good face with them. We've got to let them know that we know, you know, you're here. So he says, we'll drive out there in about 75 feet or 100 feet or so. We'll turn the car sideways. You'll be in the passenger seat. They'll take a picture of you. We'll go and they'll be happy. But they didn't know. Hopefully they didn't know what we were doing up there. But they knew I was up there.
And right.
So I'd make a staff visit to the detachment and see that things were going in accord with what we required. We could tell basically by the reports. But
sure.
Always good to drop in and say hi and how you doing.
This was a morale thing.
We had three Air Force type there, and the rest of them were Norwegians.
Okay, and the Air Force personnel, how long would a tour up there be?
One year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so kind of showing the flag and being interested was a very good idea, because of course they're very close to the Soviet border too.
Yeah,
and
very close. They're right there.
And the dissatisfaction among those people is not a good idea.
Well, the eastern city limits of Kirkenes is almost on the border. That's
and
how close.
When you were up there, and you're of course very close to the border, and that would probably be a very electronically defended border, if nothing else, by the Soviet Union. Could you see anything on their side?
I've seen their checkpoint, but beyond that, it's just
ice.
Snow.
Snow. Okay, so all the way from that point in northernmost Norway, your yeah. operations went?
Yeah, all the way down to South Africa, Johannesburg.
And did you ever go down there?
Yeah. I've been all over the world. I've been all around the world, to speak. Yeah, but that's another story. But we had two more detachments in Norway, in and around Oslo.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have any in Sweden, none in Finland. But we had three in Germany. We had none in France. None in Switzerland. None in Austria. None in the Eastern Bloc, naturally.
Right.
And but in the beginning, let's see. In Greece, we had two. In Turkey, we had three, plus an air operation out of Incirlik, just monitoring the air activity down there with our pods.
Okay.
And let's see, the...
was that a continuous thing that you would continuously have someone
in? Under... USAF Europe.
Okay.
Their airplane with our pod.
Got it.
And then coming back across North Africa, we had one unit in Tripoli, Libya, and that's the only one up in that general area. And then the most of them down in a big part of Africa, southern Africa, were mostly in the embassies and all
mm-hmm.
that I described earlier. They didn't do any paper sampling down there. They just did the ball sampling.
Okay.
And your attaché was doing that for us out in the little cabinet in his office that exhausted to the outside. Well, I should say, exhausted.
Yeah, sucking in the air. Right. And sort of inhaling into those steel balls. Yeah. And how often would they send? I mean, the air attachés. There must have been some protocol for this. How often would they do this sampling?
It would take the air attaché. Those little compressors we use. I mean, intake pullers we had on those. It'd take about 3 days to fill the bottle, and he would wait and send probably three or four at a time. Mm-hmm. I mentioned diplomatic pouch one of them. Diplomatic pouch can be as big as this room.
Double.
Right.
So that's how those were handled. And then we'd ship him some by return pouch, empty ones, clean ones.
Would he then send them in every 3 months, or what was the frequency?
About every 3 months we'd resupply. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But so I visited those, briefed the ambassadors.
Okay.
And all that about how we were doing and what the progress was. And he might have known through the State Department, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Always a courtesy call.
Sure. Always a courtesy call to the ambassador, the DCM, or mm-hmm. whoever's running the mission.
And many other countries in Africa we had these. I don't recall all of them, but I know Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
But anyway... Rhodesia, South Africa, Kenya, Ivory Coast, Ghana, Brazzaville, Congo.
Congo, mm-hmm.
And some others, but I don't remember. Interior.
Mm-hmm. Ones. Now, in speaking of Europe specifically, did we do this kind of sampling, a program like this, or a detachment in France itself?
Didn't have any detachments in France. The detachments were in Germany.
Okay.
In fact, in Western Europe, we only had three detachments there. And they were all in Germany.
Germany, okay.
And then we skipped down to Greece, and then over to Turkey, and then back around the northern rim of Africa, Tripoli. Well, Tripoli joined.
Now, in the Middle East, what regional office?
Oh, okay, Middle East.
Uh-huh.
We had...
was this, again, reporting to Wiesbaden, or did it report somewhere else?
Okay. Mm-hmm. All the way over to Ceylon.
Okay.
And India.
Wow.
We had two detachments in Iran. We had two detachments in Saudi Arabia. We had three detachments in Pakistan. We had one in India and one air attaché type in Ceylon. And I visited all those on a pretty regular basis.
You did.
And one interesting incident, we had two detachments in Iran, mm-hmm. and we needed a third one right up on the Caspian Sea mm-hmm. to monitor closer to one of the Russian, one of the Soviet Union test sites. And our headquarters had briefed the general. They gave permission for the other two. But this one was in the Shaw's game preserve, private game preserve, right on the Caspian Sea. So the general says, I ain't got no authority. Through our sources, he said, I ain't got no authority. See your State Department. So they made arrangements for a briefing to be given to the Shaw to get permission to establish this detachment. So I was designated to go brief the Shaw of Iran. And this guy was astute. I mean, he was sharp. Technologically sharp.
Where did you meet him, Jim? Tell me everything you can about that meeting.
I walked into his office, not a palace. I was escorted into his office, and I saluted naturally.
And this is in Tehran?
In Tehran. Mm-hmm. He was very cordial.
Yes.
He said, I know exactly why you're here. Introduce me to General so-and-so over here. I know exactly why you're here. Just tell me all the details, what this will encompass up there, mm-hmm. and what you expect of us. Mm-hmm. Very simple. I did that, and he says, you got just these exact words. You got it. Just tell General so-and-so exactly what you need. He heard you say it, so go to work. So that was our third
detachment. So he dispatched that very quickly.
Oh, yeah.
No friction, no upset.
He was so pro-Western.
Yeah.
A genteel guy. He was a dictator.
Right.
But he was a genteel man. And he brought the Iranians out of hell when he made them pro-Western, westernized, that is. They came out of Shigars and all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
It's kind of close.
That's right.
And then the Ayatollah came on and took over there backward.
That was a...
Here you go.
That was a hard... Yes, you're right. You're exactly right, Jim. That was a hard, very hard time when he was overthrown.
It was.
Of course, he came here to Lubbock. And do you know anything about that? Or
all I know
his son training here and so on?
Had cancer. Yeah, his son was training. I knew he had cancer.
And
he went to MD Anderson also.
That's right.
And then to what... an island, I think.
I'm afraid I don't know. Actually,
I don't remember.
But it was so politically dicey. His son trained here at Reese, and there are lots of people here in town who remember him.
I'm sure.
Had him here and spoke so very well of him. Still do speak very well of the whole family.
Yeah.
So it's amazing that you had that that meeting with him. Did you ever see him again?
No.
But he left an impression on you, it seems.
Yeah. So, let's see, we got through.
So that was Iran.
Okay. That was encompassing our detachments throughout that part. Maybe we didn't have 75.
You're totting them up pretty well here. The number's getting...
Counting the embassies and all, it got pretty close.
Now, you mentioned Ceylon or Sri Lanka now. And India, I suppose, and Pakistan, both of which, of course, are now established nuclear powers, but at this time were not. Can you tell me any incidents you recall with regard to visits, say, in Pakistan?
Very cordial mm-hmm. up until, let's see, I was in Wiesbaden from 62 to 65,
uh-huh.
and the Pakistanis were very cordial, gave us everything we wanted in Pakistan up until probably late 64. And all of a sudden, on one of our detachments up in Lahore, Pakistan, mm-hmm. a knock on the detachment door one day, with all secure compound,
sure.
had guards at the gate and all. A knock there, and the Pakistani guard came in and told the detachment commander, Captain so-and-so from Pakistani Army needs to see you. So he went out there, and here Pakistani guy is with his AK-47. You have 24 hours to vacate. And our detachment commander says, wait a minute, we're... Anyway, he pleaded his case, but we were... He immediately called the Wiesbaden and talked to my boss, the commander of the field office there.
Yes.
And said, here's what's happened. He had to open telephone. We couldn't do it. Could have sent a TWX, a Twix, mm-hmm. telegram, mm-hmm. but that would have taken.
So he just picked up on an open line.
Open line.
Okay.
Uh-huh. He says, I've got. Here's the situation. I've got. And the boss says, close it down. Mm-hmm. And we always had some kind of explosive there to take care of the equipment.
Right.
So they closed it down, pulled a string, and left.
And blew it up, essentially.
But before that, to show you cordiality.
Sure.
In Tehran, in Karachi, we had a big detachment there of three different techniques, and we had a big compound there and a big dormitory for the guys and all.
Oh yeah, okay.
And the Chinese came to the Pakistani people and whoever's the head, I don't remember. And said, we want to build an embassy on that spot, right next door. They didn't even talk about us. We want to build an embassy right on that spot, but it was right next door to where we were.
Mm-hmm. Just pick that out of the blue.
Yeah, mm-hmm. out of the blue. So whoever the contact was mm-hmm. came to our detachment commander there and said, here's what's happening. They want this. We don't want them to have it, but it's hard to say no in a diplomatic way. Mm-hmm. So, do we know what you're going to do is put monitoring devices there to monitor you. mm-hmm. But tell your boss in Wiesbaden that we want to work with you all very closely in the construction of their embassy.
Very closely.
Very closely. So, to make a long story short, we had all kind of sensors embedded in the walls and whatnot of their embassy there. And the CIA then moved into our detachment, the compound, to monitor all that. We didn't, but they moved into our compound.
And did you continue, did the Wiesbaden office continue to have operations in that compound as well as having the CIA guys in there?
Yeah. Until this 1965 incident, or late 64, they did the same thing in Karachi. They moved us out of there, too.
Okay.
And also up in Islamabad, the capital, they moved us out of there where we had a detachment.
So you had, did they move you out permanently, or did you just relocate?
Permanently.
Yeah, because this is the time when Pakistan and People's Republic are getting mm-hmm. more friendly and turning
in
against
fact,
India.
Up at the Peshawar, near
Peshawar Pass,
one of the other kind of secret services had a detachment up there, and they had to vacate that also.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah. What? I've forgotten which one it was now. It was
not CIA. Source. Somebody else.
Yeah, they weren't monitoring nuclear like we were.
Sure. Right. Right. Well. Let me ask a couple of questions and see if it sparks anything you'd like to say about during this period. For example, let's just try this one, the Cuban Missile Crisis. Did it have any impact on the operations of what you were doing?
Not us.
You guys continued doing what you had been doing anyway. Okay.
All that did was the missiles that came down to Cuba, they weren't in our bailiwick. The nuclear warheads came with them, I guess, but we weren't responsible for that.
Right. So it didn't hurry up your operations or accelerate the pace.
The only bad thing about that crash is one of my good buddies that flew the U-2s out of Australia that I made a real close acquaintance with down there. Mm-hmm. His name was Anderson. He was the U-2 that got shot down by a Cuban missile.
He was the one?
Yeah. That was the only connection I had with the Cuban missile crash.
Wow. But that's still upsetting that you... The U-2, this is earlier, of course, but the shoot down in 1960 of the U-2s, you would have been already with AFTAC at that point. Did it have any impact? Did, for example, I don't know whether you can say this, did Gary Powers have a pod on that plane?
No.
He did not.
So help me.
Okay, I believe you. I don't know.
He was on strictly other missions.
Okay.
And I don't even know whether there ever been any discussion about putting one on it. That was before, in the early time when I got there.
Sure, absolutely.
But we did not have anything to do with that U-2.
Okay. Now, the U-2 aircraft were being flown on numerous different missions and presumably were, I think you mentioned, did at some in some cases carry pods for you?
Yes, in Australia.
For AFTAC. Was that the only place? Or
no. I'm sorry. Out of Del Rio, when they were stationed at whatever the air base is there. Still there.
Anyway. California?
No, out of Del Rio, Texas.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, okay.
Just up the Rio from Laredo.
Okay.
What's the air base there?
That's where Mac was.
That's 60. That's 86 years old.
That's okay. You know, someone will look it up. We'll have them look it up.
We would fly. Let me think a minute. We had pods down there. We had operators down there. Why did we? We didn't. I can't answer that. I don't remember.
Okay.
But I had to make staff visits down there out of Sacramento occasionally. But why can't I remember why?
You'll think of it later.
You can call her.
Oh, sure. We can always add to this.
We dispatched them from there to Alaska to get high altitude samples from the Pacific Rim, and or at that time we were still at Clark Air Base in Manila, and off of Guam.
And U-2s are flying out of there as well.
Okay. We'd have SAC dispatch one or two, mm-hmm. just to get high altitude samples. After we'd made but in hopes we'd get contact. And when we got contact, then say here it is now. We can track it because we have weather stations at these various sites and islands.
Okay. Another again timeline point, and this surely did not. I think report probably to the Wiesbaden office, but you know, in 1964, the Chinese demonstrated their nuclear capability with that explosion at Lop Nur. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me anything about that? Remember?
Well,
I mean, them establishing nuclear capability in terms of international relations was very important.
The only thing there with us. We got involved in the same thing we did on the Pacific Rim. Once it triangulated Lop Nur,
right.
We just tried to get a forecast. And we had better options of forecast there because we were friendly with Thailand and the Philippines and all that.
Oh, sure.
So
you had a lot of options around the rim.
A little bit more
the Pacific Rim.
Than way down there, South China, than we did the others in Novaya Zemlya and Semipalatinsk in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
So all we did was take samples from here to AEC from there.
Okay.
It didn't have any impact on us. Well, our detachments were activated, but that was our mission.
Did you ever go to India? Did mm-hmm. we have detachments in India?
Mm-hmm. We had a detachment in New Delhi,
mm-hmm.
and from Lahore, I could go over to New Delhi very easily. Got up to Taj Mahal.
Did you?
Mm-hmm.
What was that like?
You couldn't fly.
You could talk about that prince building something for his princess or the king, whatever it was.
Right. It was a love thing.
It was lovely. I'd like to have taken her.
Oh, I bet you would.
We've been around the world together, but not that high. She didn't get to hit India.
Now, Minnie Mae, had you moved to Wiesbaden? I take it that you
yes,
had.
Yes, we lived there.
Okay.
I was overseas 6 times, and that was the only time they could go
that's
3 years to Wiesbaden.
Yeah. But, you know, you have to look at the whole picture. Mm-hmm. He had a great career, and I enjoyed it, too.
Oh, you must have. You must have. Now, how did the kids do with growing up in Germany a little bit?
They did fine, and they both remember so much about Germany and Europe. Mm-hmm. And I was thankful they were the ages they were, because they couldn't remember.
Our daughter was junior high, and our son was high school. Mm-hmm. American schools.
Yeah. They did go to the American schools?
Yeah, we were in the best place. Wiesbaden was a beautiful cultural city. Mm-hmm. Right across the river, Mainz was just a river.
It was not bombed during the war. Mainz across the...
It was the industrial...
The Rhine River. It was industrial. Boy, it was torn down, but Wiesbaden...
I haven't been there.
Beautiful city. And we had government quarters there. Mm-hmm. And...
Not on the base.
No, they were in little sections around the city. But we enjoyed him. Made some good German friends. Mm-hmm. They visited us.
Our son particularly enjoyed it because he is a race car nut.
Oh, really? Oh, boy.
And he was a...
Explorer Scout.
Boy Scout, Explorer Scout. And the Explorer Scout troops' goal was to see every racetrack in Europe. And they did.
They had an American leader who was married to a German.
He was an insurance salesman over there, and he'd just take off whenever he wanted.
And he could take them with him?
He'd take a van.
He'd take a couple of vans.
Oh, what a riot.
And these kids, they didn't pay no attention to fences or anything. They got right down to pits with the drivers, the crews. They'd steal flags off of the fences.
Climb up a tree.
Kids will do.
My son, he says, "Dad, everybody does that." I said, "You ain't everybody, son. Yeah. If you get caught, what you gonna do?"
Did he ever get caught or in trouble for any of that?
They were lucky.
They were lucky.
But he still loves racing.
Coincidentally, in Dallas, they have a racing school at the Texas Motor Speedway.
Oh, they do.
And on April 2nd, he's coming up and going to take a one-day course there, driving one of the NASCAR cars.
So this is not something that ever went away.
No, he loves. He watches all the races.
He can tell you.
He's got the bug.
Every race car driver's name, what his winning percent. He's a brain on races.
Wow. He's a brain, but he's that's his love is racing.
Wow. And did that get started in Germany, or was it already
He started taking car and driver when he was in college.
Oh, boy.
Boy, if that postman wrinkled up a cover of that magazine, he was furious.
That's so far off the subject.
Yeah, he probably still has all this fun.
Well, Jim, let me ask a little bit about the observations. We've talked about the Soviet Union and China a little bit, but can you tell me... anything about the observations that were made on France? Of course, I'm thinking that most of their testing was in the South Pacific. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yes, except for Algeria.
Oh, Algeria. You're right. I'm sorry.
They popped a couple in Algeria.
That's right.
And we were not prepared for that. And all of a sudden, we had to schedule some airplanes over there in a real big hurry. Mm-hmm. And we got what we needed from them down over Libya and over in Kenya and that area. Mm-hmm. And then returned them back.
But it was a surprise.
It was a surprise.
The shots in Algeria.
They would tell us. And I'll tell you a little incident about their Polynesian shots. Mm-hmm. We got word to the CIA. We worked very closely with the CIA. The CIA had their U-2 detachment at 1717 8th Street, I think, in Washington, D.C. Okay. That's immature. Mm-hmm. But I used to go talk to them about their U-2 operation versus SAC's U-2 operation. But we didn't have anything to do with their U-2s, just friendly.
Right.
Because we worked with another area.
But you worked with SAC U-2s only, SAC for the pods, means, not CIA.
Pods,
okay,
right.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm clear.
So, or what?
So you're going to talk about the Polynesian shots that went to...
The CIA told us about French were going to pop one down there. So we deployed our good old C-118, a half-tax airplane. Where did we deploy? I forgot. New Zealand, I think. I think it was at Christchurch. Mm-hmm. And it had a long, good long range. We had an internal tank in it also.
Okay.
And our technicians were out of this world. You can't believe it. The quality of these guys. It ran these all these shows. And one of my guys said, you know what? I'll bet they have an operations center down there. Hell, I bet they have television centers and watching what they're doing down there. And I'll bet I can fix up something in that bird of ours and tune in, maybe find a frequency that they're on. And sure enough, he took a television with him. He turned in, and we were looking at their operation. He was looking at their operations center.
Looking at the French operations center?
French operations center in that C-118 before they shot.
Oh, gosh.
Now, that sounds impossible to me, but it happened.
That's some impressive electronics right there. I can't even imagine. Do you know what year that would have been?
Air folks in, that was... Oh, well, let's see. It's when I was McClellan. I was McClellan 65 to 68, so it had to be in that era. I don't remember when.
When you knew that they were going to, when you had this foreknowledge that they were going to do a shot, did the tempo of your operations change then?
Mm-hmm. We put airplanes in Panama, and let me think. And also the Philippines, because the Polynesia is pretty close to the southern hemisphere, mm-hmm. and we didn't know where what was going to go.
Right.
And but Panama was the one that paid off. It went east.
Okay.
But the air debris did.
Okay.
So that's as close as we ever got, except just out over the open ocean, sand.
Okay. Now. How did you come to the... Well, let me first ask. You were at Wiesbaden 62 to 65. Mm-hmm. And then from 65 to, I'm going to guess, 68 when you left AFTAC. Where were you based?
Sacramento.
You were in Sacramento that whole time? Okay. And you moved back to Sacramento with the kids?
Yeah.
Okay. And the Sacramento office was the largest?
Yes. Okay. Well, it was... Other than Washington headquarters,
D.C.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, uh-huh.
This was the largest regional.
Because we had, in addition to the ground techniques and my air techniques, we had the big laboratory there, the biggest of the three. The one at Eielson probably had, well, I don't know, I'm guessing now, maybe 14 people there.
Mm-hmm.
And the one at Yokota, maybe two or three more. But the one at in Sacramento, it must have had 70 or 80.
Okay. And I wonder whether the different labs involved checked each other. Mm-hmm. Did you do more than one test on each?
Yeah, they would. Yeah.
Okay.
They would. For an example, if the Alaska lab got a paper
right.
and analyzed it, they'd also send a copy of it to McClellan. Of course, some of the isotopes would have died, not many, but enough. And then they would coordinate their activities, the Yokota the same.
To make sure they were getting accurate readings, they would... Mm-hmm.
McClellan would always send some of their people, these other two labs, if we got real hot samples, be there with them while they did the analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a set of orders that allowed me to travel anywhere in the world. No, wait a minute. I'm sorry. Anywhere from the longitude that goes, it's west of Alaska, all the way through the longitude that goes through Ceylon and India.
Okay.
And the latitude through the very southern tip of South America and all the way up above Kirkenes in Norway. I can go anywhere, anytime, by any mode of transportation, regardless of cost.
Wow.
To get to a point, if it was an emergency we needed to. And maybe there's another dozen people that had that same type of order. And I only had to exercise that once. The Russians popped one at which was it? Novaya Zemlya, is that Banana Island or the northernmost point that they didn't need. It's an island up north, way up north in the Arctic Ocean. And it's
either probably on this map right here.
Okay.
Oops. Kamchatka.
Here, right here. Novaya Zemlya, right there.
Oh, okay.
And Semipalatinsk is way back down in here somewhere.
Sure.
And then Chukalovnor is down here. But they popped one up at Novaya Zemlya, and instead of coming east, it turned around and went west. And boy, you talk about having to get in a hurry. We didn't have to.
You weren't set up for that.
We weren't set up for that.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to deploy to one of the English air bases and go to the base commander and say, hey, here's what's going to be coming in right here, and we got to have this, mm-hmm. this, and we got to have it in a hurry. I ain't got no money. 1-4. And he, when the airplane got there, we were ready to operate.
What's 1-4, the reference to the priority?
The priority. Uh-huh.
Okay. So that means carte blanche.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Whatever money it takes.
Did you have any, were there any tensions with
no.
the British
well, oh, yeah,
about
there was.
This?
Initially, the tension was until we got the airplanes there and could begin to get sampling, because we weren't sure whether we'd get there in time before we were on all. Well, we knew we'd go to get it eventually, but
right,
we'd
but
be
out
in the Arctic Ocean somewhere.
Right, but you wanted it sooner, obviously.
Yeah,
you always wanted it sooner.
As soon as we could.
Yeah, and that would be a priority, too, for D.C., right, mm-hmm. for the people in Washington.
That's right.
What was your title when you were at Sacramento?
Lieutenant Colonel.
But within AFTAC, before you had been Director of Operations?
I was Lieutenant Colonel. The full time was an AFTAC, the full 10 years.
What was your title? What was your job in
Sacramento? Oh, Sacramento?
Yeah.
I was Director of Operations.
So you were Director again?
I had air and ground.
Uh-huh. And who did you report to?
I reported to my detachment, I mean to my... I'm sorry.
That's okay. Yeah, it does get tiring.
To my field office commander.
Okay.
Well, he was a colonel.
Let's take a break for a second.
No, I don't need to.